Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. My guest today, former BYU offensive lineman, Braden Brown. Braden, it's always good to see you. How are you?
Great to see you, Jason. It's great to be seen. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's great to have you on the show, but I get to see you quite a bit around campus and with various teams. I get to see you with football, get to see you a lot with women's basketball. For those that maybe aren't up to date on what you're doing these days, give everybody an update on your status right now. What does your life entail right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So back in, I guess, December of 2022, my family and I had just moved back from Indiana after being there for about 5 years, and a company that I work for currently, Ampelis, was in the process of signing a contract with BYU Athletics, and luckily that happened, and ever since then, I've kind of served as the director of mental health and mental performance for the football team, women's basketball, gymnastics, and swim and dive teams, and it's been, honestly, my dream job. When people ask me like how I'm enjoying it so far, like I literally tell them this is like my dream job. So I'm just grateful to be here.
So the title, as you said, director of football mental health, but you also deal with other teams. What does it exactly entail? We hear mental strength coach, and I think people hear those terms a lot. But what does that entail in terms of duties, things that you do, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so it's kind of broad reaching, right? So I have more of like a clinical mental health background and training. So I'm actually a licensed marriage and family therapist. That's what I got my master's degree in, and then I got my PhD in medical family therapy. So most of my training has been in the clinical mental health space, but a lot of my research and clinical work focus, especially the past 5.5 years, has been pretty exclusively with elite level athletes. But it kind of ranges anywhere from anxiety, depression management, to goal setting, motivation, confidence, focus, things like that. So it's kind of a broad range of the things that I deal with the athletes, but it's a lot of fun.
Gravitating towards the athletic side of things, is that strictly because of your background, or was that something that you had always thought would be interesting regardless of the fact that you played football?
Yeah, I think that my involvement as an athlete my whole life and being kind of in the sport world, and then also my experience here at BYU and then my brief, you know, stint with the St. Louis Rams, I think that definitely kind of helped pave ultimately where I wanted to end up in working with athletes, just because I feel like it's a demographic and population that I can relate relatively well with. But when I started this path, I really had no idea that this is where I would end up, and I'm so grateful that this is where I am, because I couldn't have painted a better picture.
Well, you touched on a couple of things. You mentioned the Rams and the opportunity to you know, go through BYU, and we're going to get into all that coming up throughout the course of the podcast. But I'm curious, in your position here on campus, are you meeting with every player? Is it something that is a requirement that the players meet with you or someone like you? Or is this only if a player is interested or reaches out to you? How does that work?
Yeah, so it's not a requirement, although I think it should be a requirement. But I do a lot of team-based stuff. So I get with the teams about once a week. We usually call them like a Mental Monday or Wellness Wednesday kind of meeting. And then from there, usually the athletes will reach out to me individually. I will have coaches come to me and say, hey, so-and-so is kind of going through it right now. Have they reached out to you? Would you be willing to reach out to them? But it's kind of a mixture of the team-based stuff, but more so the one-on-one individual work. And I feel like that's where a lot of stuff can get really worked through and some improvements can be really made.
This is somewhat of a common thread on a lot of the episodes of the Deep Blue podcast that we've done. I've had Craig Manning on this show. We did an episode with Craig. And one of the things that I have said in multiple episodes is I think in athletics in general, I think the two things that, at least in the last decade, have really risen to the top, and certainly in terms of things that weren't necessarily focused on that are now, analytics and the focus on mental strength and mental health. Like, those two things over the last decade have increasingly become more prominent. Why do you think that is? What has changed that people are much more willing to discuss things of a mental nature, where as opposed to, you know, 10, 5, honestly, even just a couple of years ago, a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. What has changed?
That's a great question. I think that it's kind of multifaceted, but I think the biggest thing is there's just been a greater overall awareness around the issue. So I think that maybe 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't a lot of data collected on mental health specific stuff when it came to NCAA athletics or professional sports. But now the NCAA sends out a survey every single year asking specifically about depression, anxiety, relationship issues. And I think like for 5 years in a row now, the chief medical officer for the NCAA athletics has attributed mental health and relationship problems as being the number one issue for all student athletes. And so when you have kind of the top dog coming out and saying stuff like that, and then you also have the data to support it, I think that, you know, it's something that can't be avoided anymore.
How has the transfer portal and NIL and all of those things that just seem to add another layer of stress to everybody, how has that changed the college athlete and their mental health, do you think?
That is a great question. And I don't know specifically, because there's not really hard data to kind of show what that looks like. But I do think that it increases the overall level of uncertainty.
Sure.
And anytime there's a high level of uncertainty, that usually kind of is a breeding ground for anxiety and stress and overwhelm. And on top of everything else that these athletes are dealing with, right? Being an elite level athlete, the training hours, you know, just the physical, mental toll, and then, you know, being a student as well and relationships. It's a lot to try to navigate.
When you look back on growing up, you can't think of anything better than doing what you're doing right now. When you look back on your life, was there something that you can look back and say, yeah, this has kind of always been there for me? Or did this just sort of, as you got older, you just gravitated towards it? Was there anything in your past or your upbringing that would have led you to this type of work?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a couple specific instances. So when I was in high school, I actually went and saw a therapist. She was a psychologist in Salt Lake City, Utah. Shout out Dr. Mattis. Wonderful woman. And kind of initially I was like, you know, I don't know if I want to do this. It's kind of like the typical stigma around mental health, right? I was a three-sport athlete. As I've gotten into this field, I've learned that that's kind of a common theme, especially for male student athletes, is there's usually a higher stigma associated with, you know, having mental health issues or reaching out to somebody. And I found it to actually be really helpful for me, not only as an athlete, but just in my relationships and just how I thought about things and how I just lived in my day-to-day life. And then fast forward a few years to my playing career here at BYU. Yeah, we had Craig Manning, who's a total stud. He'd come talk to us in kind of a team format a couple of times. But I never really worked with anybody individually until my senior year. And it was 3 years too late, because that's something that I always struggled with as an athlete here, was like pretty severe pre-game anxiety. Mm-hmm. I found it to be so helpful. And it honestly was like two conversations with this guy, and it totally changed my perspective and allowed me just to play more freely, allowed me to play with more confidence and not be so worried about certain things and just directing my focus onto other things that were in my control. But then I go on, you know, and once I retire from football because of injuries, that was kind of an interesting moment in my life, because I thought that I would maybe always go into coaching mm-hmm. after I was done with my playing career. And then thankfully, I called Coach Mendenhall. I'm on the drive back from St. Louis, and Coach Mendenhall, in his infinite Coach Mendenhall wisdom, he said, I love that you're excited about getting into the coaching field, but why don't you talk to a couple of the GAs to really make sure you know what you're getting yourself into before you take that leap? And so I said, okay, if that's fine. I met with two of the GAs, one of whom was Kelly Papinga, mm-hmm. total stud. And then Jason Walker was the other one. They basically said the exact same thing. And I was trying to start a family at the time with my wife. And I was just like, I don't know if getting into the coaching world and, you know, all the hours and moving all over the country before you land somewhere. And then it's kind of like year to year job stability. So I'm like, I honestly had no clue what I was going to do. And then it was my wife who suggested going into the therapy world. And in fact, she asked, she said, have you ever thought about like being a therapist? And in my mind, I went to that place of, it's crazy, because I did think that's something that I could potentially excel in and do well with, just because of, I've always felt like I have a good ability to relate well with people and just to, I don't know, be personable with people and just listen to people, you know?
Yeah.
But there was that stigma, like, here I am, this 315-pound offensive lineman going from being, like, the mean, nasty persona to now, like, sitting in a room with people talking about feelings and emotions. And so, like, my initial thought with that suggestion was people are going to think I'm, like, a creep or a weirdo, you know? But then I thought about it, and I'm like, it's a cool way to still be involved in, like, the coaching world, but just in a different arena and helping people with the mental side of things and emotional side of things and relationships that play a huge role into performance and how they play in their respective sport.
So I was wondering if this was going to come up. Since you brought up your playing weight, anybody that would look at you today would not have any clue that you were that big, because you are in great shape. Obviously, you're tall, but what was that? How has that affected you? Because I don't know if you want to say what you weigh now. That's totally up to you. But you look totally. In fact, the first time I saw you, and it had been a long time since I had seen you. At first, I didn't even recognize you because you had lost so much weight. How has that dynamic changed things for you?
Yeah, that was quite. And I was actually having a conversation with one of my colleagues on the football team about this yesterday as we were walking over to Lavelle Edwards to do some of the stadium steps. But so I came here as a tight end. I redshirted 2008 as a tight end. I started the 2009 season, third string tight end behind Dennis Pitta and Andrew George. Actually got some playing time as a tight end. And then it was halfway through that season, they switched me to tackle. And I learned really fast that I was an undersized tackle and I needed to put some weight on. So between redshirt freshman and sophomore year, I put on about 55 pounds. And sometimes that might sound fun or appealing to people, but it was brutal. Like it turned into a full-time job really quickly. And there were some nights, I know this sounds petty, but there were some nights I would literally think about the fact that I had to wake up the next day and do what I had just done all over again. And I'm like, there's just no way. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this.
Because it's these big meals or these very hearty snacks.
Yeah.
Like every couple of hours to put on that weight, isn't it?
For sure. Like every 2 to 3 hours, I was trying to eat a meal that had about 1,000 calories in it. And then sometimes between those meals, I'd drink, you know, like a True Mass protein shake that had another 800 calories in it. And I'm like, by the end of the day, I'm like, I am literally so sick and tired of eating food that it totally took away the enjoyment and just like the normal process of just eating and like just for, you know, the enjoyment factor. It became a chore, it became a job. And so it was kind of brutal. And then I got up to, the heaviest I got in St. Louis was 317. And that was when I was like, okay, like this is just too much, you know? And since then, it's been kind of a roller coaster. But I do feel like, especially with athletes, because that's such a common thing with athletes, especially football guys, trying to gain weight, keep weight on, lose weight, whatever it is. I feel like that helps me kind of relate to their experience and know what it's like to do that because I spent so many years going through kind of the same thing.
Have you noticed a difference in your own mental health based on your weight?
I would say so, yeah. And it's hard to attribute it to specific things, but when I was in St. Louis, I was physically kind of a train wreck, and then also mentally and emotionally I was also just not in a good spot. And I feel like part of it was because of my weight, just because I was like, my back was always hurting, my knees hurt, my ankles hurt, and so I think just being overall more active and having less body weight for me has been something that's been really good for me overall.
Well, hey, again, since this is a podcast, people can't see this, but all you need to know, if you have not seen Braden recently, the dude is svelte, he's jacked, he's in great shape. Whatever he's doing, it's working. So congratulations on that. So I mentioned a minute ago, I used the word upbringing. So let's talk about your upbringing. Give everybody an idea of what young Braden Brown was like and your family dynamic, where you grew up, and what it was like in the Brown household.
Man, I just got done playing a round of golf with my dad, and I was playing with a guy who met my dad here at BYU. They were the student body officers or something, student body presidents and vice president or something together. And that was the comment that the gentleman I was playing with made about my dad. He's like, I met your dad, and he was just like one of the most unique people I'd ever met because he was just so competitive and just like tried his hardest in everything and was kind of like passionate about everything. But he was also just like a very nice, gentle guy. So my dad came here as a baseball player, and he played one season as a pitcher and then went on his mission and then came back home and then decided just to focus on school. But from the time I was probably 4 years old, I'm the second of five in my family. I have an older brother that's 15 months older than me. And we played competitive baseball, basketball, football, any sport you can imagine from the time we were like 4 or 5 years old. And I think that was because my dad kind of had that competitive nature. And so growing up, I was raised in a very competitive environment and a competitive household. But also, I was a very big kid. So I don't know if you've seen that clip of Andy Reid when he was doing pass and kick thing.
Yes.
So I wasn't quite that level. And I still, every time I watch that clip, I think it is fake. Like, there's just no way. But it is just so, it's so comical because it's just so bizarre.
Yeah.
But I was a big kid. Like, I was a kid in elementary school. They had to bring in a desk from the middle school because I didn't fit in the elementary school desk. And if you look at my pictures from when I was like third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, like, I was legitimately probably twice the size of most of my classmates. And my mom had to bring my birth certificate to all my football games and basketball games and baseball games. And
really?
Big time.
Because you had the other parents like, hey, what's going on here?
And I heard it, too. I heard the parents say, like, there's no way this kid's 10. Like, he's the size of the coaches. And I remember, like, I was always so hopeful every year because you have the weigh-ins. And if you're over the weight limit, they put a big X on your helmet and you can only play offensive line or defensive line. And also you can kick. And so that was the one cool thing I got to do every year in Little League is I was a kicker. And I would just try to kick the crap out of that ball. But so I heard this, and it's like that was also something that actually really affected me. And I think that, going back to what you were asking about, I think that kind of started my journey with, you know, just becoming who I am today is because I was made fun of. I was called fat boy. I was always asked, why are you so big? I heard all the comments from other parents. And I'm just sitting there thinking, like,
how can it not affect a person?
Like, I don't know any different. Like, it's not my problem, you know, like, I can't really affect this. And I remember I'd go home and I'd cry to my mom and I'd say, you know, why do I have to be so big? Everyone makes fun of me. And it was hard because, like, my older brother was a total stud athlete, good looking kid, really smart. And, like, everyone loved him. And I was known as Les Brown's younger brother my whole life. And I was always like, why can't I just be more like Les and more, you know, more athletic and more handsome, whatever else? And it was hard. And so I think for me, that kind of helped me be able to relate to people who go through similar experiences because I didn't want anyone else to feel that way. And so I think that kind of helped, I don't know, develop me into the compassionate, empathic person that I try to be today.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back in, we're going to get into your playing days in high school and then ultimately what led you here to Provo and the BYU football program. We'll have more with Braden Brown after this on the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shepherd. Happy to have former BYU offensive lineman Braden Brown in studio with me today. Always good to talk with Braden. We're going to get into your playing career coming up in just a second. But before the break, we were talking about your upbringing and your family dynamic. And I wanted to ask you about something that certainly had a profound effect on your life when you were very, very young. Tell everybody what happened when you were about 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah, so my family was living in Washington State at the time. My dad's actually from Washington, was born and raised there. He was just starting a PhD program in accounting. So my dad kind of paved the path for me to go down the PhD route to kind of finish something that he never ended up finishing because of what happened in Washington. So it was a late night in January. I usually woke up in the middle of the night because I usually get thirsty at night. And so I walked down into our living room, or at least I started to walk down, and I saw, like, you know, a big glare of light. And so I thought, oh, my dad's probably just working late. And then as I walked down the stairs even more, I just saw a bunch of smoke and flames everywhere. And so I ran up into my parents' bedroom. My parents shot out of bed. So I had a 5-year-old brother. My older brother was about 5. My sister was probably about 2.5. And then my second youngest brother, Trevor, was just a little baby. So my parents got all the other siblings. They got out of the house. And in the meantime, I went and hid because I was just a scared little 4-year-old. And they get outside of the house, and my mom looks at my dad and says, where's Braden? And so my dad ran back into the house. At this point, it was fully engulfed in flames. And I remember my dad screaming my name, asking where I am. And I said, I'm scared. And my dad said, I'm scared too, but we got to get out of here. I couldn't see anything because there was smoke everywhere. And I just remember hearing like this big bang. And then I kind of like slid towards the front door. And then we get outside of the house and I look up at my dad and he was just completely charred. Like all of his hair was gone. He was black and bloody. And it was a pretty traumatic experience. And I ended up spending about 12 days in the hospital. My dad went to the burn intensive care unit for a little over 3 months. Doctors initially gave him a 30% chance to live. And they didn't let me see him for like a month because he was so swollen and in such bad shape. And they almost had to amputate some of his fingers. They had to do some pretty significant skin grafting. And so I thought my dad died and I thought they were just lying to me.
At four years old.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And so I didn't really realize it at the time, but then as I was going through my master's program and PhD and I was learning more about like mental health conditions and I'm reading through like anxiety disorders and separation anxiety, it dawned on me. I'm like, man, that is something that I struggled with pretty significantly my whole life. I couldn't sleep in my own bed until I was like 12 because I would get panicked every single night. And I realized that I kind of attributed it to that experience with the house fire, like with the significant loss. I could never have sleepovers. I couldn't go on scout camps. And like for me, it was one of those things again where it was embarrassing, but yeah. It was also like very real to me. And so it was hard to kind of navigate. And then as I got older, I actually got a mission call to go to San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I went into the MTC and it was just like panic attacks just like all day long. I couldn't sleep. It was just like I felt like I was having a heart attack. And so I came home early. And that was something that was also really difficult. And that's probably the lowest I've ever been mentally and emotionally is because it was just like this huge thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a young man in the LDS church and being surrounded by people at BYU, and it's like that's usually the first question is like, oh, where'd you go on your mission? Mm-hmm. And then you kind of have to get into like, well, I didn't go. And then it's like, well, why not? And then you have to kind of feel like you have to explain it. Yeah. And some people are like, oh, everyone gets anxiety. And, you know, that's not a legitimate excuse and whatever else. So I ended up just like telling people that I did go, you know, because then it just saved the conversation. Yeah. But it was something that affected me pretty significantly for a long time.
Well, since you're willing to share that, I will share as well. And this is not something I talk about publicly. In fact, I'm not sure that I have ever talked about it publicly in terms of to masses like this. But I went through the exact same thing, 100%. Now, I did not have anything traumatic like what you talked about at the age of four. But my whole life, I was the way you were in terms of separation anxiety. If there was ever a sleepover, it needed to be at my house. I was not comfortable. I would go through panic attacks very, very often. And then when I got my mission call to Cleveland, Ohio, when I left and went, the panic and the stress and the anxiety was so severe, I was giving myself ulcers. Mm-hmm. And basically, I had to just ultimately make the decision to either stay and deal with it or go home. And I wasn't doing anybody any good,
yeah.
Myself included, staying out. And so I decided to come home. And to this very second that I'm talking with you, it has affected me and still does to this day. I still feel like a failure. I still feel like, why couldn't I do it? You know, what's wrong with me that I couldn't do it?
Yeah.
I did what I could, but it's real. That is a very real thing. I think also the thing that was the biggest concern was that when people come home from their mission early, what most people think, oh, what did they do?
Yeah.
And it wasn't a case of that.
Yeah.
And I didn't want people thinking that. I'm like, if you have a question, ask me. I'll tell you. Now, nobody did, and quite frankly, I was embarrassed and didn't really want to tell anybody either, sure. But I'd rather be able to tell them than think that I had done something wrong that sent me home.
Yeah.
So it's very, very real. Like I said, it still affects me to this day. The coming home and not being able and still feeling like a failure. To this day, I still feel like a failure.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that we can have this conversation because I feel like it's something that there needs to be more attention brought to it because you think about like if it was a physical condition, right? Something that you can actually see and something that there's proof of, then like there's usually not a lot of questions about it, right? It's like, oh, it makes sense. Like, you know, the guy has some sort of like medical condition that affects his ability to serve, you know, the way that he needs to be able to, right? But when it comes to the mental health stuff and you can't really see it, then all of a sudden it becomes like this taboo, like kind of questioning, like, really, are you really dealing with that? Or are you just being soft or being weak? And so I think it is kind of tricky. And then coming to BYU, gray shirting 2008 in the winter, my first class was sociology, and we're talking about cultural norms, and temple marriage is one of the first topics that got brought up. And there was a young lady in my class who raised her hand. She's like, I will never marry anybody that didn't serve a full-time mission. And so I'm sitting there thinking, like, I'm a month removed from just coming back from the MTC.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I'm like, I'm screwed. Like, there's no, like, I have no hope, you know? Like, there's, and I went into a pretty deep depression that first 4 months that I was here at BYU, because I thought, like, you know, there was no hope for me. My life was over. But then there was another young lady who raised her hand, and she said, that's actually a pretty shallow take. She's like, you should be more concerned about them being worthy to take you to the temple, whether they served a mission or not. So then that kind of, for me, and then I ended up marrying the youngest daughter of a former mission president. But it's something that it's taken me a lot of years to kind of be at peace with. And I still have moments where I'm like, you know, what if? So
yeah, it's real. I don't really know how to transition from that conversation to football. So we'll just do it very awkwardly and jump into your football career. So through high school, was college always an option for you in order in terms of playing? At what point did you realize that this was going to be something you were going to be able to take to the next level?
I think it really probably started my freshman year at Judge Memorial. So I went to Judge Memorial for 3.5 years. I played 3 football seasons there, and I had the opportunity to start on the offensive and defensive side of the football as a freshman at Judge. And I think that my coaches there were kind of like, hey, if this is something that you want to get serious about, like, you have the size, you have the ability, like, you could be a Division I football player. And that's something from the time I was 8 years old, 10 years old, you write down, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's like, I want to be a professional football player. So it's something that I always kind of wanted to do. But then this became a common theme in my life, even when I got here, is I just didn't really believe in myself or think that I could do it. But I was surrounded with a lot of great coaches and a lot of people in my corner, family members, et cetera, that believed in me. So that's kind of when I first knew it. And then basketball was actually always my favorite sport. So then I realized, like, as a basketball player, I'm going to be a 4 or 5. I'm a 6'6" white guy. I can't jump out of the gym. And unless you're Foose, you know, you don't really play 4 or 5 at 6'6" at D1 level. So that's when I really started to realize, like, okay, football is probably where I have the greatest ceiling. But I still played 3 sports in high school, and I'm grateful that I did, but football was always kind of like, I knew that I was probably going to have a legitimate shot to play at the D1 level.
Was BYU the dream school? Was it always the top of the list? I know you had mentioned that, you know, your dad went here, and so obviously it was in your blood. Did you guys grow up BYU fans, and it was always going to be BYU or bust?
Yeah, so both my parents went to BYU. We grew up coming to BYU football games, and in fact, I still vividly remember BYU versus Utah. They kind of run the option to Brandon Doman, who was my offensive coordinator, pitches it to Luke Staley, high steps up the sideline.
I remember it well.
Touchdown to win the game, and then we storm the field afterwards. And I will never forget this moment. Ryan Denny, number 92, he was my all-time favorite player. Like, I wanted to be just like him. And so I went and I found him. I was probably like 10 or 11 at the time. And he shook my hand and gave me one of his gloves. And that, like, for me, that was like one of the coolest moments of my entire life. And so from then on, I'm like, I want to be a BYU football player.
What did it mean to you then to be able to go to BYU? If that was the goal and the dream, to be able to achieve that dream, what did that mean to you?
Honestly, that's something that I haven't really learned to appreciate or even acknowledge until like the last 5 or so years, until I've been so far removed from it. And you reflect on those moments and it's like, that actually was pretty cool that I was able to have that experience and accomplish, you know, making it to the Division I level. Because I think when you're just kind of in the thick of it, you don't really stop to reflect or think about it. But it is something that I'm really proud of, and I'm really grateful that I got the opportunity to do it. And sometimes I wish I could just go back with what I know now and my wisdom now and relive those years. But, you know, so goes life.
You mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you had come to BYU as a tight end, and then you were behind some pretty prominent guys that everyone knows, Dennis Pitta and Andrew George and guys like that. And then you were asked to make the switch to offensive line. So Had you played offensive line before, or was this foreign to you? Take me through that process and what it was like to switch positions once you got here.
Yeah, so my last experience on O-line was my Little League days, because freshman through senior year, I was a tight end slash DN slash wide receiver. But for me, it was kind of like, and going back to my upbringing, like my parents raised us to be team players. And it's like, you put the team first, and whatever the team needs is what you need to do. And so when Coach and I came to me and said, hey, do you want to do some cross training at tackle? Because we're kind of low on numbers. I was like, if that's what the team needs, I'll do it. And it was awkward at first, right? You learn how to kick step. It's not as easy as it looks. And it's not just a matter of, you know, block the guy in front of you, which is what a lot of people think it is. So there's a lot of technique. There's a lot of nuance to the position. And you're kind of on an island. So it was awkward at first. But then, you know, Coach Weber was one of my offensive line coach here. He was a great coach. And I was surrounded by so many talented offensive linemen that kind of embraced me and put me under their wings, like Matt Reynolds and RJ Willing and some studs, Terrence Brown. And so they kind of helped show me the ropes a little bit and show me the ways. And I actually got to start two games that year as a redshirt freshman, and I was about 255 pounds soaking wet. So that was like my welcome to college football moment. So,
well, and your head coach was Bronco. You mentioned Bronco before. The interesting thing about what you do now, and looking back on Bronco is very much a self-help guy, someone that would seem to embrace the mental health side of the game. Is that an accurate statement? Was that something that was very prominent when he was the head coach here and you were playing?
Yeah, I think that Bronco was a huge accountability and discipline guy, right? He wasn't about pointing fingers. It was about, this is kind of how we're going to do things. This is the culture. And it's like, you either join us or you get left behind kind of mentality. And it's like, I don't care who you are coming out of high school. I don't care what your name is, how many stars you have. It's like, you're going to earn your position on this team. And if you don't, then that's kind of on you, sort of thing.
There are some players playing now that were part of Independence and now part of the Big 12. You were the other end of that. You were part of the Mountain West and then Independence. Take me through that changeover in that part of BYU history that you got to see both sides of.
It was kind of an interesting time. So I think 2009 was the last season in the Mountain West, and that was my redshirt freshman year. So it was fun to be a part of a conference where you had rivalries and you got to play for a conference championship. But it was also kind of cool to be a part of something new and being able to travel to places like Ole Miss and Notre Dame and Florida State and play in some like really cool historic college football venues. And so, yeah, I mean, it would have been fun to be able to play for more conference championships and, you know, stuff like that. But I thought it was a unique time to be a part of the football team.
Do you have a favorite game, favorite memory? I'm sure you get asked all the time. Do you have one that really stands out to you?
Man, there's a lot. I mean, honestly, speaking of the rivalries and stuff, but I would say that 2009 game against Utah. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I'm so grateful that we ended up winning that game, because I gave up a big-time sack at a pivotal moment in that game, and that was my welcome to football moment. And that's something that I've actually been wanting to talk to Coach Satake about for a long time, because he coached against me for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, like, what was the scouting report when you were talking to your guys about me? Because he was a defensive coordinator. Yeah. And same thing with Jay Hill. It's like, be real with me. What were you telling your guys when you were scouting me as the offensive tackle? But I will never forget the moment. I go out there. Matt Reynolds goes down. They say, Brownie, you're in. And so I go out there. I take two kick steps against Koumisi, who ended up being a second-round draft pick that year, buries me into the ground, climbs over my body, sacks Max Hall. But luckily, we got the overtime win. Andrew George catches it in the middle of the field, takes it for a touchdown. That was a pretty cool moment at home, getting a big-time rivalry win.
That was a pretty cool moment for a lot of people. Yours truly in the mix with that as well. So you go through your BYU career, and then after your senior year, you do get an opportunity in the NFL, and you actually get an invite to the combine, which is certainly a good sign. What was that last year, and then going into that offseason, knowing that the NFL was a possibility for you?
It was kind of a full circle moment, because it was like, from the time I was 8, being a professional football player is what I always wrote down as my life goal. And now I'm to the point where I'm like, I actually have a legitimate shot. Like, I'm getting to the NFL combine. Not a lot of guys get that opportunity. And so, you know, maybe a draft pick at the very least, maybe picked up as an undrafted free agent. And so it was kind of a cool moment. The only thing that was unfortunate about it is like my body at the time was just a train wreck. I had back issues, hip flexor issues, shoulder issues, ankle issues. And it's like, it's common for guys who play 4 or 5 years of college football to come out not all in one piece, right? But I remember very vividly sitting at the combine, having a one-on-one conversation with the coach, and they're asking about my back, and like I literally can't sit down in a seat for more than like 30 minutes without my back just writhing in pain. And he's like, how's your back been lately? Any issues? And I'm like, no, I'm good. You know, because it's like once you get that opportunity,
yeah, you don't
want to
have it slip through your fingers.
Like I've played through it for 4 years. Like I'm not gonna. What's one more week? You know, until I get my chance. But so like when I reflect on that phase of my life, I wish I could have just been a little bit healthier physically to see if I could have had a chance. But throughout OTAs and mini camps, like my back was kind of a train wreck, and so it was just. I'm glad I got the opportunity because I probably would have wondered what if I didn't. But I wish it would have been, you know, a healthier version of me that got the opportunity.
Well, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but you signed a free agent deal with the then St. Louis Rams.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you? I understand everybody wants to be drafted, but you signed a deal with an NFL team. That had to have been an unbelievable moment for you.
That was really cool. And it was also a little awkward, too, because I go into the locker room and Sam Bradford's our quarterback and, you know, the whole Sam Bradford BYU beef.
Yeah.
So that was kind of awkward. I don't even know if he ever actually knew that I was on the team.
Speaking of 2009.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a big-time game. That was probably my second. Getting that my second favorite memory of a football game was getting that win against Oklahoma. That was a big-time win.
Yes, it was.
But yeah, walking into a film room and onto the field with guys like Jake Long, and it's like, holy cow, this is a former first-round, like, number one overall draft pick. And then you learn really quickly, like, why that is the case, because the guy's just a freak of nature and fast and athletic and agile and strong and whatever else. But it was a cool moment for sure.
So you mentioned that because of the injuries, it just never allowed you to do what you wanted to do, and ultimately you decided to make the decision to leave. Was this decision, even though you had the health problems, was it an easy decision, or was it still really hard to say goodbye to something that had meant so much to you for so long?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision for sure. Because the reality is I could have come back and tried to keep playing. That's what my surgeon told me. He's like, you know, guys come back from the surgery and play, but it's just a matter of quality of life and you know, what you want your life to look like when you're 40 and 50 and at that point, I was in such a rough place physically and mentally that I'm like, I want to be over it. But then there was a long time for that year after. Like, it was hard for me to even watch football. I'd always watched BYU, but it was hard for me to, outside of BYU football games, it was really hard for me to have any involvement with the game, just because it was kind of like something that was a part of my life from the time I was 7 up until 25 years old. Now it's just like gone. It was kind of an interesting moment.
How much does it help to be in the position, though, that you are now, back at BYU, a place that you know and you love, working with athletes, doing what you love in terms of the field that you've chosen? It really does kind of feel like the best of both worlds for you.
100%. I seriously feel so blessed and so grateful to be able to work here at BYU, especially kind of on the mental side of things, because it's something that I went through and struggled with significantly. And I feel like it's, in a way, giving back and helping people, you know, and not making it about me, but just understanding that's a huge part of it. And feeling like I can make a difference, even if it's just with one athlete, is kind of my mission.
Do you feel like you have earned maybe more respect from some of the players because they know that you've been through what they've been through in terms of specifically here at BYU?
I think that definitely helps. I think the fact that I kind of, you know, walked the walk, so to speak, even though it's so much different nowadays, but I do think that does give me some credibility, because it's kind of like, and I've heard this a lot of times, like, you get it, like, you were a student athlete, or you get it, like, you know, you were kind of in the thick of it. And I think it does help me kind of understand the headspace that they can get into, like, during winter conditioning and spring ball and fall camp, and kind of just when things become a grind and you got to kind of dig deep and remember your why. And I feel like if I hadn't had those experiences, I probably wouldn't be able to connect with them as deeply on that level. So I definitely think that it does have its benefits.
All right, Braden, last question before we wrap things up. What's the future hold for you, do you think? What's the next 5-10 years look like in your mind?
I hope that it involves exactly what I'm doing right now. I hope that the company that I work for, Ampelis, can continue to work with BYU Athletics, and that I can be kind of boots on the ground helping with as many student athletes as I possibly can. And not just the student athletes, but also coaching staff, support staff, because they also play a huge role in it. But I would love to just be right here doing exactly what I'm doing.
That's what we like to hear. Thank you so much for being willing to do this. Thank you for sharing a lot of personal things today. I know that it's helped me. I'm sure that there are a lot of people listening to this podcast that it's probably helped them as well. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great.
All right. Thanks once again to my guest, Braden Brown. My name is Jason Shepherd. Josh Bergstrom and Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.